Hello, everybody, and welcome to the free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie All About, Toy Story 3. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey. I'm just drying my face. It's so stained with tears because Woody loves Andy so much. Who's here with me today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and we belong together.
That's right. The memorable Randy Newman song. You're all singing it in your cars 12 years later. But yes, on our What a Cartoon Movie podcast, we just covered Toy Story 3. And the whole podcast is likely 6 hours long. As of this recording, it's still being edited. But you have the whole thing available to you if you are a patron on the $10 level or higher at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. But yes, we've covered Toy Story 1. We've covered Toy Story 2. It only made sense to cover Toy Story 3 next. That's the way numbers work, folks. Yes. And we did it.
And we had there was a lot of interesting history that Bob covered and did research on, but also it went extra long because we had a lot of memories and childhood ending thoughts to parse out in this podcast. And
yes.
We had a lot of fun doing it.
A lot of the podcast is about Disney battling Pixar.
Yes.
And their eventual consumption of Pixar.
The bad guys win. Yes. Spoilers. Yes.
And also you'll hear about the fake version of Toy Story 3 that they almost made. The
That's
details
right.
behind that. It's all happening in the entire podcast. You're going to hear a brief preview of that 6 hour long podcast. Again, if you want to hear the whole thing, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up for $10, you get to hear the whole thing, and you'll also get to access the other What a Cartoon Movie podcast, over 3 years worth of 3 to 6 hour long podcasts covering things like A Goofy Movie, Beavis and Butthead Do America, Rocko's Modern Life, Static Kling, other Disney stuff like Aladdin and The Lion King and Hercules. You name it, we've probably covered it, and if not, we'll cover it soon.
Very soon, yeah. And I mean, this is almost as long as last month's Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is our longest to date and probably will never be topped at 6.5 hours. And you know, when you sign up at that $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you also get access to all of the $5 stuff we do, which is a monthly exclusive episode of Talking Futurama, a monthly exclusive episode of Talking of the Hill, and the entire back catalog that covers all of our previous episodes where we cover Futurama, King of the Hill, The Critic, Mission Hill, and 10 of our favorite Batman the Animated Series episodes. That's so much stuff out at your fingertips. 5 years worth of exclusive bonus stuff on the Patreon at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
That is it for this brief intro, folks. Now get ready to hear a brief preview of our very, very long episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about Toy Story 3. Let's talk about what happened before the Disney-Pixar merger. So to recap some stuff from the Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2 podcast, Disney gave Pixar a very crappy contract, but it was a huge opportunity for Pixar, so I don't blame them for taking it. It's like, we're working with Disney, they're screwing us. But you know what? They're distributing our movies, the Disney name is on it, and you know what? Who knows? Without the Disney name, who knows if anyone would have seen Toy Story?
You know, as Lotso says, you gotta start on the bottom, and if you play by the rules, you'll get to be in the good room.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
But yeah, so let's go over how crappy this contract was once again. So along with owning the story and character rights, Disney also had the rights to make sequels to Pixar movies themselves without the involvement of Pixar. And of course, I'm not going to tell the story again. Disney made their own Toy Story 2. That was thrown away. Then Pixar made their Toy Story 2, the one that we know, in 9 months.
Yep, yeah.
And this made Pixar even angrier about Disney.
Because it also was like, does it count? Does it not count? Does it check off another? Because also in very Prison Break terms, it's like, does this count as a year on our contract or does it not? Does this get us one movie closer to ending the contract or doesn't it by doing a sequel?
Not only did they have to kill themselves making a movie in 9 months, that movie did not count towards their deal with Disney. So like extra resentful, extra bitter. Obviously, Disney wins in the end, and it's a very sad ending for Pixar.
Well, that's depressing.
Yes. And it's a story of ruthless capitalism. So to provide context, here's a brief history of business relations between Disney and Pixar. So in 1997, after the major success of Toy Story, Pixar signs a 5-picture deal with Disney. That subsumes their original 3-picture 1991 deal.
I see. So it expands it by 2 movies.
Right.
Okay, got it.
And it feels to me, based on the math, it feels to me that the 5-picture deal starts with A Bug's Life, because between that and Cars, it's 5 total movies, not counting Toy Story 2, which doesn't count.
Got it. Yes. Got it, man. Okay.
And so more about this proposed Pixar contract. So Steve Jobs wants a new contract for Pixar that will get them more money and more freedom from Disney. So Jobs wants Pixar to fully fund their own movies and pay Disney only 6-8% just for distribution. But under the old terms, this is the terms that Pixar was working under. Disney funded half of the movie, but they only gave Pixar about 38% of the revenue. And on top of that, they took 12% of distribution.
Man, so, yeah, a crappy deal for them. Also, when you mentioned the late Steve Jobs there, it also, you know, in like 93, 94, whenever, when they were working on the first Toy Story, Steve Jobs isn't Steve Jobs as we knew him in the aughts. Like, he's like, oh, he used to be Steve Jobs. Like, oh, he's the old Apple guy. What's he done for me lately? And so I would guess he doesn't have the same juice for a deal that he would by, you know, even by the year 2000,
yeah,
the Apple is reborn. Like, he's made it cool again. And this is even before the iPod changes everything, including our ability to have careers.
Hey, that's true. Thank you, Steve Jobs.
Thanks, Steve Jobs.
And your pods.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are constant attempts to renegotiate this contract in favor of Pixar. These all failed. Again, Pixar only wanted to give Disney distribution rights. They did not want Disney to have control of their intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge sticking point for Disney is that Pixar wanted the terms of this new contract to apply to movies currently in production. So while all this is happening, Steve Jobs and Michael Eisner are feuding in the press over the fate of Pixar's new contract. This is all happening in the early aughts.
Mm-hmm. You know, in that Disney War book, I've been thinking about it more since the Roger Rabbit thing too, and just how certainly Jeffrey Katzenberg is an asshole, like he is, but I think his jerkiness overshadows Michael Eisner so much, because like Katzenberg is also just a more like detestable guy, like he,
yeah,
just makes you go like, egh. And while Eisner at least seems like a friendly enough guy if you were to hang out with him, but so many of his decisions as a boss are like bullying jerk tactics. Like he kind of feels like he, especially like all these stories of like, you know, he didn't believe in Pretty Woman. He didn't believe in Roger Rabbit. He thought Dick Tracy would be the big hit. He makes all these giant mistakes over and over again.
There are lots of stories of Katzenberg being a jerk and throwing his weight around, but it seems that for the most part, he trusted the animation teams because he was not an artist. He,
yeah,
was not a storyteller.
Yeah, and it sounded like as much as he would jerk them around in like story meetings, he would at least like, all right, you guys deserve a bonus or whatever.
Yeah.
Like he'd at least start writing some checks if pushed to do it. Eisner, I don't think, cared as much either.
This is one of the few podcasts where Katzenberg is not present and Michael Eisner is the villain. Katzenberg,
yeah,
at this point in time, he's off in like DreamWorks County making, mm-hmm, tons of money on Shreks.
I mean, the Disney Renaissance, once they ran out of the Katzenberg approved projects with like, you know, Mulan's still pretty good, but I do think that it's a downturn after Katzenberg isn't, you know, not that he's, it's the animators who make them good, but the producer does something.
Oh, that's another good point, Henry. At this point, Disney is in the shitter
because
Pixar is making the movies that get all the attention and acclaim. Disney is making a lot of flops. Lilo and Stitch is like the rare big hit from them in this time period. Even then, it's like a modest hit, I believe.
Oh, it can't compare to Toy Story 2 money-wise,
yeah,
though. It's, I love Lilo and Stitch, but yeah, it's, you're right. That's an important thing too. As opposed to Roger Rabbit, which a reason that Roger Rabbit never got a sequel to is that Disney didn't need it because they could put all their money on just the hit factory they were doing. But by the late 90s, early aughts, they don't have that hit factory. And Pixar, just through Pixar's success, makes them look shitty. Like, people, it's like, oh, this new Meet the Robinsons or whatever. Like, this looks like crap compared to a Pixar movie.
God, yeah, they're making big, expensive flops.
Chicken Little.
Let's see what else. Like, even 2D movies like
Home on the Range.
Atlantis, Home on the Range,
yeah,
Treasure,
yeah,
Planet. They're not doing well, and their reputation is being ruined because they are spending a lot of time making all of this direct-to-video garbage that,
yeah,
everyone is making fun of.
Yep, they're making direct-to-video shit. Like, and on top of that, DreamWorks is starting, like, with Shrek, is starting to actually compete with them, too.
Actually, around this time in college, a Disney guy came to our school. My friends were in art school at the time, so I went with them to this presentation. I forget who the guy's name was, but he was working on Chicken Little, and he was showing off a lot of test footage. but he was also making fun of Pixar stuff a lot.
Whoa.
And he was showing off The Incredibles, like a clip from The Incredibles, when they're all in the water. He's like, look how distracting this is. Look at all the attention to detail they put into making these characters look wet. It's all just a bunch of useless work they have to do. Like, there's one guy, Pixar, that just works on eyelashes. It's crazy. Like, it was like Disney and Pixar were at odds. People forget this. Like, man. Artists between both sides were kind of throwing shots at each other.
Wow, I didn't know that. I mean, you know, it's I think, too, it's that... which that got smoothed over in the after purchase thing, but it was like, it was the Bay Area versus LA too. You know, Pixar was all the way up here and they'd have to, you know, it's an easy flight, but you can't just like get in the car and yell at them across the street in Burbank. Like you can, if you're Jeffrey Katzenberg in Los Angeles.
It's true. Once again, I'm reminded we could just walk to Pixar if we wanted to.
Yes. Yeah. I've driven by it many a time, but never, boy, I'm really jealous that coworkers of mine, when this movie came out, I wasn't high up enough to get the good trips at the Games Press website I worked at. But as a way to promote the Toy Story 3 video game, which who the fuck cares about the video game? It was tour the Pixar studio. So you can write about the video
game. It's very important for you to get this nice, fun trip for you to write, you know, unbiased reviews. Hey, we need to send you to Disneyland to look at this new Star Wars game.
Yes.
It wouldn't make sense if we didn't.
Wouldn't. No. You know what? If I had gone, I would have had the ending of the movie spoiled for me.
Oh, okay.
Because my coworkers who went there, they said that the final shot of them watching Andy drive away was like painted on a big like wall inside there. So it was one of the first things they saw. And they're like,
oof.
Well, I guess I know how this ends. All right. No tension here for me.
You dodged a real bullet there, I think.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the history. Go back to the history,
yes.
Rather. So, Steve Jobs, Michael Eisner feuding in the press. And then the news breaks in late January of 2004. Steve Jobs announces that after 10 months of negotiations, Pixar will be seeking another distributor in 2006.
Man.
At this point, it was assumed that Cars would be a 2005 release. Now, something I find deeply tragic, I don't like Steve Jobs, but I feel like all of this like infighting with businesses, all of these meetings, and you're dead in 5 years, buddy. Look
yes.
at all this wasted time.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. I guess, I'm sure we'll all have that moment of like, oh, I've wasted my life. But no. But for him, especially.
In meetings.
Yes, in meetings. When he's richer than God.
Yeah.
Like, he's so crazy rich. And just in endless meetings. I mean, the Michael Eisner wasted his time so much. Well, also, hey, you know what? Who else got killed after doing a ton of meetings, died early? Jim Henson.
Oh, you're right.
You know, this Michael Eisner acquisitions, like, honestly, the stress of it, I do think is a health negative on people like Steve Jobs
it's
and Jim Henson.
The Eisner curse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Pixar announces we're going to be seeking a new distributor. Everyone's interested. Everybody wants Pixar.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
It was crazy news at the time. Like, wow, Pixar and Disney... separate entities, like what will Pixar do? You know, that was such a interesting vision of the future we had then. It's was not to be, but
I think better future, more interesting future,
perhaps. So. Yeah.
So based on the timeline I put together, it sounds like Michael Eisner announced Disney would be making their own Toy Story 3 one day before Steve Jobs announced Pixar would be dumping Disney after the release of Cars.
Dirty dog, man.
So I don't know if Jobs was responding directly to that announcement or if he had his announcement planned for a certain day and Eisner knew about it. I don't know, like, who knew what, but these were like literally one day apart.
I, you know, again, from that Disney War book, that definitely sounds like the Michael Eisner trick of knowing that somebody's going to announce something on Monday and putting out a press release on Sunday. Like that does sound like the Michael Eisner trick book there. Yeah.
But this backfired on Eisner in a huge way. So his treatment of Pixar pissed off Disney shareholders to the point where it seemed unlikely that Eisner would be reelected to the board of directors. And he was regarded in such negative terms that he stepped down as CEO 1 year before his contract expired.
Owie.
Yes.
Man, yeah.
That's how much he was hated within the company for this Jobs feud.
That's right. Do you remember the... Family Guy did a whole joke about that, where they go to Disneyland and it's the Indiana Jones ride, and then it turns into a long parody of Temple of Doom, except the Kali Ma guy is Eisner trying to kill Peter Griffin, and then Peter Griffin knocks him to his death in self-defense, and then he says, Yeah, you know, Mike Leisner, you should have listened to your stockholders.
Okay.
So, yes.
So that was ripped from the headlines at the time.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, he stepped down as CEO, I believe, in 2005, and thus began the reign of Bobs.
Yes.
Bob Iger, Bob Chapek, powerful Bobs.
Bobs are taking over. And what was one of their first hires? Bob Zemeckis to make a Christmas Carol.
These Bobs, hey, you know, yeah. I want to keep doing this, but I'll take a lot of money from Disney. So we'll get to the eventual consumption of Pixar when we inevitably cover Cars, but that's the context we need to... explain the alternate first version of Toy Story 3. But to summarize everything so far, Disney clearly wanted Pixar to be a sequel factory, and they tacitly strong-armed them into making Toy Story 2.
Mm-hmm.
And after the merger, we would see a lot of sequels. We would have Finding Dory, Monsters University. We'd have Incredibles 2 and, you know, Cars 2 and 3 and Toy Story 4. So Disney won.
Yes, yeah,
they got what they wanted.
They got their way. When it started, it seemed like, no, there's still original ideas. There's Wall-E. There's all, but we didn't realize that was them shoving out the last of their original ideas.
Yeah.
But then it was time for Sequel Town. But yeah, they do still make original stuff that I like, but as like Onward, that basically stars me and you. But yeah, but meanwhile, it there's no denying it became a sequel factory. Like, you just look at the record, that's what it was. But to man, I think we all knew then, like, oh, I'm now going back to 2004 and remembering that feeling of like, man, it's gonna be sad to watch a shitty Toy Story 3 that's not really a Pixar movie, and I guess I'll watch it anyway just to see what crap they do with it. But I'm sad, yeah, but while also happy that Pixar will seemingly get to make original things elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to talk about the fake version of Toy Story 3, which almost happened, but it probably never was going to. So let's talk about the Circle 7 version. So Circle 7 Animation was a new animation group established by Disney just to make sequels to Pixar's properties. They were like, you guys will just make CGI movies to sequelize Pixar things they already made. So it was founded by Michael Eisner.
Of course.
It lasted basically like a year. And after its closure, almost every employee was absorbed by Walt Disney Feature Animation.
You know, the Walt Disney Feature, they were then getting more and more into 3D, so they need skilled 3D people anyway. So it makes sense. But boy, what a dumb, just so crazy that like Michael Eisner hires all these people to make like nothing. And then though that as we've been learning so much here with all the people laid off at say Netflix, making nothing for a year is kind of just animation's lot in life.
I mean, it seems crazy, but this is how a lot of business works. Like, this is just a fake make-work company to prove a point and act as a bargaining chip. I've worked at those companies where it's like, I'm not at a real job. They're just waiting to sell this company. They need to make it look like a real job. And that's it.
You're just a plaything of the rich.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Yep.
That's what we all are.
Yeah.
So this is basically Disney doing their direct-to-video sequel approach, but theatrically and with Pixar properties.
Mm-hmm.
So Eisner's theory was that, like, oh, filmgoers won't know the difference between this and a Pixar. And the joke in the press and amongst animation fans, this group was called PixArnt.
Oh, that's clever.
PixArnt.
That's clever.
Yes. We'll talk about another Arnt very soon. So, this was just made to light a fire under Pixar's ass, saying, we'll make this bad Toy Story if you don't come to Papa. And, Circle 7's Toy Story 3 is set for release in spring of 2008. With Lion King 1.5 director Bradley Raymond running the show.
That's what we may end up doing eventually. It's a funny, it's clever enough, but certainly if I had read at the time that the the director of it is a direct-to-video Lion King guy, I thought, oh god, they're really not trying on this.
Yeah, he was a direct-to-video guy up to that point. Mm-hmm. Lion King 1.5 is like a was it a theatrical release or no?
No, okay. It's just VHS,
but
or DVD.
It was like Lion King 2, where they got as close as they could to theatrical.
They certainly spent more money than they did on Return of Jafar or whatever, or Bambi 2. I think for Lion King, they'd spend a little more, but still not theatrical level, no.
So lots of ideas were pitched internally, including a whodunit mystery of toys disappearing in the attic of Andy's grandmother. I like that idea.
I like that, yeah. It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I like that.
But one idea really appealed to Disney, and this was a rescue mission to save Buzz after he's recalled and sent back to Taiwan.
Okay, and I remember that one. Yeah.
This was reported in the press as this is the premise of the new Toy Story movie.
Okay.
And there are even like images. You can see concept art and concept renders of the recall of Buzz and characters doing different things that would happen in this fake Toy Story 3.
Man, no, I mean, it's just amazing to think of how many, like, completed and probably even, like, existing as, like, a video file animatics of all these, like, unmade movies exist, like, that you could, well, I mean, there's probably, like, a dozen animatics of unmade Roger Rabbit stuff, or and now all of these Toy Story 3s, or the Toy Story 2 that never existed as well, all that stuff.
That's the real Disney vault I want to explore.
Yeah, yeah.
So Disney chose screenwriters Bob Hilgenberg and Rob Muir to write this Toy Story screenplay. The company was very impressed with their work on a script for another proposed Circle 7 sequel that was Monsters Incorporated Lost in Scaradice. And based on what I read about this screenplay that actually went unfinished, it's one of the best unproduced screenplays Disney ever made.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Disney ever produced or whatever.
Wow. I've never heard of this this other Lost Monsters, Inc. sequel. Man.
There was also like another, like Finding Nemo 2 was in the works too. They had all of these sequels in the works to scare Pixar.
Man, and little did they know that the Cars would be the biggest hit of them all too. Yeah, I was just reminded of Monsters University because that's the fucking trailer that plays at the start of the Roger Rabbit Blu-ray. I'm like, oh, yeah, Monsters University.
it's that old, that Blu-ray.
Yep, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of Cars because I'm listening to a lot of podcasts. All right, I'm catching up. I just was on vacation, and Scott Gardner is a newer father. He's got a little boy, and the Pixar Cars hypnotism has got his little boy in their clutches.
I know. It works. It's crazy how well it works on kids.
Yeah.
It's nuts. Yes, I listened to that same podcast this morning, and he mentioned a thing about Cars that never really landed with me until now. They're like, oh yeah, they have tongues. They have flesh tongues that come out of their mouths. That asks a lot more questions.
It raises further questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, with Toy Story, you ask a lot of questions about the reality. With Cars, it's like, it's a litany of questions. You can't stop asking them. So let's talk about these screenwriters, Bob Hilgenberg and Rob Muir. Who are they? Well, these are two groundlings. They were up-and-coming screenwriters in Hollywood thanks to an unproduced Love Boat movie spec script. So there was a lot of buzz behind this Love Boat movie spec script because it was a real send-up of the Love Boat, and it was going to be a Brady Bunch movie-style movie.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Where they're having fun with, all the plot lines you remember from the Love Boat.
Yeah,
We all know what happened. I've never seen the Love Boat. I was there for the Brady Bunch movie. I'd seen the reruns. I was like, I know what they're talking about here. They're talking to me.
No, Love Boat, I only knew it for like, well, that's well, Charo was on it a bunch, and I've actually seen Charo play live on a cruise ship in my childhood.
Oh, wow. Yes. You were living the Love Boat. So they broke into TV writing because they knew Rhonda Shear from USA's Up All Night.
Oh, wow, man.
And they wrote a lot of bumper segments with her. I don't know if they wrote the Gilbert Gottfried ones. Maybe they bled into the Gilbert Gottfried ones. You know what? As a little kid, I wasn't quite yet horny, and I was always mad when it was a Rhonda Shear. I was like, where's Gilbert?
I feel you, yeah. Even though now you look back on it, it's like, oh, the point of these was not to be funny. It was for Rhonda Shear to wear very little clothing and say cute things.
She was a non-spooky Elvira.
Yes,
and
yeah.
They did a bit of slumming. They also wrote for shows like The Munsters Today.
Ugh,
so
The Munsters Today.
Bad. Waiting for that Rob Zombie movie, everyone. It's going to rejuvenate the franchise. Hey, it could be good. The Addams Family movie for that franchise.
And you mean the 90s one, not the CGI thing. You've seen those.
The first one is a good like 6 or 7 out of 10 movie.
Okay.
Second one's bad.
A Gentleman 6.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, blank check.
So what happens in this fake Toy Story 3? Well, I read a summary. I think the entire screenplay is online. I didn't want to read the entire screenplay. I'm sorry. It seems like a fun caper that isn't trying to put a period at the end of the franchise like this movie did, but then had to like retcon in Toy Story 4.
Right. Yeah.
But it fits into the Pixar movie mold in that it's a rescue mission followed by a journey back home, and there's international flair in that it takes place in Taiwan.
Wow, man.
So they journey to Taiwan, they go to the factory, they meet some new friends, they get Buzz back, they send him back home. And they send the evil villain toy to Sid. Oh, no.
Oh, so Sid returns. Man, I wonder just what they would do in Taiwan in a mid-aughts sensitivity level there.
That concerns me. Yeah. There are some things in this movie, even in 2010, for a 2010 movie, I'm like, they wouldn't do these jokes today.
We're a bit more
sensitive about like gender and,
This was in the Lasseter era. There's a different time.
He's a body Hawaiian shirt dad. who knows how it would have turned out. But, it's probably for the best that Pixar got to make their own vision, even if they were forced to.
You know, it's I guess it sounds like Toy Story 2 all over again. It's just like, no, yeah, please let us have some quality control. We'll make it.
And just for the sake of being thorough, some articles credit this script to screenwriter Jim Hertzfeld, who might have done a final pass on their script. In case you don't know who he is, he's mostly only known for Meet the Parents.
Oh, okay.
And the sequel.
I mean, once you have a hit one movie, you probably do a pass on like 800 movies.
Yeah.
And then eventually, I would guess it still is probably exactly like what the critic parodied in 1993 of.
Right.
He wrote a script that would never be made. And they're like, so can you rewrite a Ghostbusters movie? And that's your life in Hollywood.
Then. He was living the J. Herman lifestyle. Before he met Meet the Parents, he wrote another movie about meeting people, Meet the Deedles.
Oh, wow, man.
I only know that movie because on the soundtrack, which I didn't buy, there is a Rivers Cuomo song from his side group Homie,
yes,
that he established, but when Weezer was on hiatus.
That's right.
That's some trivia for you kids.
Yeah. I only know it as a Napster download. But,
oh, yeah, I got the Napster download. I think I still have it. American Girls is the name of the song.
What a classic, yeah. But meanwhile, I think also on podcasts, right, they pointed out, like, Meet the Deedles is not a movie about guys with giant blue hair. It's surfers.
Nope.
But I only knew it as a poster.
Yeah, it's not the high concept comedy you thought it was.
I didn't have easy access to it until now in the beautiful future of Disney Plus.
Oh, it's on there, right?
Yeah, now okay. I can watch it whenever I feel like it, I never watch it.
I'll never feel like it. So obviously this movie is canceled when Disney buys Pixar for $7.4 billion.
Woo!
With the deal being finalized on May 5th, 2006. It was announced on January 25th, 2006, but it took all of those months to get all the machinery in line and get all the shareholders on board and all that stuff.
Deals aren't done until, you know, people can announce deals, but until it's actually like signed on the dotted line and the government also signs off on it, which obviously they happily do with the further consolidation of media.
Absolutely.
In this country.
We love monopolies.
Yep.
So I was reading this article and the premise was like, you won't believe how Bob Iger convinced Steve Jobs to sell Pixar to Disney. It's this incredible story, and it's not incredible. It's just like they had a meeting and Bob Iger was like, come on.
Yes, yeah.
And I heard like, oh, they did a whiteboard exercise and Steve Jobs loves whiteboard exercises. Ugh. It's just like, they make it sound like some advanced executive thing. They were writing a list of pros and cons.
I know. That's so dumb. I mean, if you don't add the mysticism to it, then it really is just like, then it'll seem like, oh, executives are just like you and me. They're just like any other dumb asshole. But if you add like, oh, no, it was whiteboard technique. It was all this like magical thinking. You certainly couldn't handle this type of thing Steve Jobs does. I mean, in general, I hate the Steve Jobs worship. Like, it sucks. And we live in Silicon Valley where they love Steve Jobs. Everybody's like, well, I'm the new Steve Jobs. Like, people are able to do very successful scams by wearing a black turtleneck and just talking like him.
If he survived, we would hate him as much as we hate Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and all of those guys.
Man, if he, he'd probably be on Twitter just as stupid as the rest of us are on there.
So the real story is how did Disney buy Pixar? The real story is bribes.
Yeah, they paid him a bunch of money.
Huge bribes. The bribes, I'll talk about them. As part of this deal, Steve Jobs became a board member of Disney and the largest shareholder of Disney at 138 million shares.
Wow.
For the remaining 5 years of his life.
Yeah, it's so, boy, what would Disney be like now if he was alive and had like kind of veto power and guidance on things at Disney?
I can only imagine. And also, John Lasseter, a massive bribe for him, a legal bribe.
Yes.
John Lasseter was made like king of Disney, right? He was appointed head of all feature animation and also was given a major role at the theme parks. And that's why Cars Land opened in 2012. We know what happened to John Lasseter. Fuck him. But he was basically made the next Walt Disney. He's like, you are the king of all animation and even theme parks. That is how they were able to sell Pixar to Disney, these just huge status changes for both Steve Jobs and John Lasseter.
Yeah, no, and look, I won't lie, at the time, I welcomed that.
Me
so
too, me
much.
Too. Yeah.
Like, I was like, John Lasseter, obviously in the press, was seen as like the genius of Pixar. He was the director of most of their best ones. We hadn't seen Cars yet to know that, like, well, maybe he's not as good as he used to be.
Yeah.
But and then he, you know, you hear the stories behind the scenes like, oh, he's going to kill all the direct-to-video shit. He's going to actually invest some more in the parks. Like, I never felt like going to Disney California Adventure because everything I heard about it was, this sucks. This is a crappy place full of half-finished ideas. And then that Cars ride unbelievably, it's like one of the best rides in the place, despite being about a thing I hate.
Yeah, it's a great, great ride that actually is like a thrilling ride, too.
Yes, it's so fun. It's such a great ride. And I hate to compliment a bad man like him, but
no, I was on board. I mean, I didn't know about the company culture at the time. I didn't know about him. None of us did. But it was like, oh yeah, he knows everything about animation. He'll bring Disney back to life.
And he's Hayao Miyazaki's best friend. He tells us that all the time. You know, it must be true. He says it.
And there's now a lot of distance between those two men.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Miyazaki in general, he seems like he's in a real coup. He becomes more of a coot by the minute.
Yes.
Who'll do like it. I'll give you a 10-minute Zoom interview, English press, and I will say nothing to you.
Young men get jokerfied, old men get cootified. But yeah, that is the story of Disney buying Pixar and just changing the company forever.
And it just turned out that it was Michael Eisner wasn't there anymore, so Steve Jobs didn't have the guy he hated, and the new guy's like, you just want money?
Yeah.
Okay, here you go. That is the Bob Chapek way. Like, this was the first thing. In 2008, after Iron Man's a huge hit, they just buy Marvel. Like, well, now we own that. And then, you know, 4 years after that, he brings out the big novelty check for George Lucas.
Yeah.
And it's just, they don't make stuff. It's something I really, and now they own all of Fox. And in general, it's something I hate about Disney as it exists now, that Disney gets to pretend like, that's right, we're the home to all this stuff, that like Disney would have never produced the first one of it, but they would buy it when it's successful from somebody else.
Yeah, Iger was the guy on board Disney. Like, Chapek is a fairly new CEO, right?
Yes, yeah.
Iger was the guy behind Marvel and Star Wars and all the other acquisitions.
Yes, that's all the Chapek. Chapek was in charge of ABC TV. He takes over, this is all in Disney World, he takes over after Eisner, and yeah, his big thing is just acquisition. You know, before, he was seeing that they kept trying to do their own thing internally, like you said, with the rip-off Toy Stories they were planning to do without Pixar. That was the Eisner way of saying, we don't need these people. Same, I hate to keep going back to Roger Rabbit, but that was the similar ethos to, like, we don't need Steven Spielberg, we can do this ourselves. Chapek went the other way. He's like, we kind of do need these things, so we've got a shitload of money. Let's just spend it.
You're saying Chapek. Do you mean Iger?
Sorry, Iger.
Okay.
Sorry. Bob Iger then said those things.
Too many Bobs.
But then, yes, from what I've read in current reporting on it, Bob Iger mysteriously at the start of 2020 was like, that's right, I'm finally going to retire. And Bob Chapek, the guy in charge of parks, he's taken over the whole thing. And apparently, nobody likes Bob Chapek. Bob Chapek has been causing a ton of problems. Kevin Feige doesn't like Bob Chapek.
I don't like looking at him.
Yes, yeah, he's a very smooth man.
Yeah, Bob Iger got the rich people memo that COVID was coming and he got out of town.
I think so. But Iger is still stuck around, like, questioning Chapek. And honestly, it's like, for example, in the press anyway, that whole thing where Scarlett Johansson is suing Marvel for a bunch of money and is pissed off at the company. That was like Chapek saying like, who cares? And then eventually Kevin Feige had to just write a giant check to Scarlett Johansson to be like, please stop causing bad press for us. We're all friends, aren't we? Here's your money. I think it's like Chapek doesn't want to write the check as much as everybody else. You know, it seems like he's kind of cheap by comparison with Bob Iger.
I feel bad having to talk just about the executive battles and the contracts and the
true
acquisitions, but it is the most interesting part of Pixar, and it was a very important part of their history that we've only kind of hinted at before.
And I have heard several times, and I think it was on the Imagineering doc the most recently I heard it, Bob Iger has the, you know, magical story of how he realized they needed to buy Pixar, that he was at the, I believe it was the opening of Disney Hong Kong, and he saw that in the parade the little kids cared the most about Toy Story characters, and that's when it hit him, like, we have to own Pixar. We can't let go of this.
That's very similar to when Michael Eisner saw that kids cared more about Ernest than Mickey, and they bought Ernest.
That's right. Yeah, very similar. Yeah.
Parades really show you what kids care about.
I mean, look, that's a good story for Iger to tell investors, but who knows just how real that is.
Well, Disney's all about telling your story, right?
It's about story living. It's about dreams, it's about wishes.
We know all the words.
Yeah.
Well, there is some Toy Story 3 production history. So Toy Story 3 is put into pre-production in the middle of 2006, officially 4 years and 1 month of production, according to Pixar. That's how long this movie took to come into being.
And yeah, I've heard our pal Griffin Newman mention too that at the same time, they're like, also, we need a ride right now. And that's when they start working on Toy Story Mania, which, as an aside, I rode that for the first time recently. And I had heard it's the best of those like arcade rides. Me and you are real gamers, Bob. I don't want to ride a fake game that's like, honestly, it's just like, yeah, I'm looking at a freaking screen, like whoop-de-doo. I want to move up and down.
This may shock you, but it is for children.
I know, but well, and that's also what peeved me off about the new Spider-Man ride. It also is just, it's a series of screens. They're like, oh, look at this screen, zippity-doo.
You know what? I like being surrounded by my Toy Story pals. The line is kind of fun. I hear it's better than the too complicated ride, that Star Wars game ride, where you're all doing different roles.
Oh, the Millennium Falcon
I hear that's not fun, and I'm kind of scared to ride it because I feel like it'd be put too much pressure on me if I'm in the wrong role.
Okay, yes, I agree with that. I prefer the theming. I think the Millennium Falcon ride theming and the queue is way better than the Toy Story queue, though I'll admit when I finally rode Toy Story Mania, the Mr. Potato Head was broken, and so he was just boxed up, so I couldn't even see fucking Potato Head doing a carnival.
That was fun. That's so fun. I'm sorry you missed that.
Yeah, but the Millennium Falcon ride, it's too many responsibilities, especially because it's you. You're probably not riding it with five of your friends, so you're gonna have some strangers in your group, and when you do that, you have to sit by somebody who's like, this fucking guy doesn't know to press the button. This guy's ruining it. I didn't save as much coaxium for Hondo Anaka because this guy didn't know to press the button. And I'm like yelling at people, press the red button.
I don't need that kind of conflict in my ride.
I know. Yes.
That Star Wars land puts me on edge. There's too much improv happening there, too.
Bright suns.
And like that Star Wars ride. We're going to talk about Star Wars. I'm sorry, but I don't like when non-union actors are yelling at me.
Come on, the Empire guys yelling at you.
Rebel scum. Anyhow, yes. I haven't been to Disneyland in a while, so I apologize I missed it. But the history is very basic because, like I said up front, Lee Unkrich, the director, is like, it went very smoothly. We got to make the movie we wanted to make. Little changes happened along the way, but there's still some interesting things to talk about. So Lee Unkrich says up front, I don't know if it's true, it probably is, we didn't look at the Circle 7 script. We didn't look at anything from that previous movie. We didn't want to be influenced by it. There were no hard feelings between Pixar and these animators because most of them were just back working at Disney at feature animation.
They didn't leave the people laid off, at least. And no, I totally understand that. Like, why be influenced by it? Start blazing your own path with that. Though I think you're right. You got to think at least John Lasseter knew what the plot was. Like, how could you, if you're John Lasseter at least, and you know somebody was writing a Toy Story 3, how could you not read that script and know what it was?
He just told them, we're not going to Taiwan. Make your own movie. up to this point in history, Unkrich was, he was been with Pixar for a long time. He was the co-director of Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., and Finding Nemo. This is his first solo directing credit for Pixar, and his second would be 2017's Coco.
Wow, man, he's a good director. He did all of those are good movies. Like, he
Coco,
did a good job.
I gotta say, the make you cry moment was a big misfire. I was like, oh, the very old woman died? Shocking.
You know, her singing the song, the Remember Me song got me, but also, speak again, if you haven't seen Coco, skip ahead a second. Again, it was like the second I saw Benjamin Bratt's character, I'm like, well, that's the villain. I know he's the villain.
It's the trick.
It's the trick every
time. And so thankfully, John Lasseter had a limited role in this film because he was in the middle of making Cars 2. Mm. That released the next year. So we got like two sequels back to back, and it still sucks to see like, oh, friendly, huggable John Lasseter and all of his toys. He's such a big kid. I hate seeing that portrayal of him in the PR material because it's all a fucking front and it's gross.
You know, I think Unkrich is also lucky that Lasseter got that big promotion because I would bet Lee, in a different world where Lasseter wasn't that busy, Unkrich would have done just as much work on it, but have been called co-director with Lasseter. Mm. I would assume he probably insists on like, no, I'm still co-director on this. But I mean, he's still an EP on this movie. Like, we got to see his name on like 5 years of movies after he got fired.
Yeah, that was not fun to do. But so who is pegged to write this new movie? Well, it's a little guy named Michael Arndt, who has far too many consonants in his last name. A-R-N-D-T.
Mm, no way. Nah, cut that D at least. Yeah. That's what I'd say with my editor pen.
But yeah, he made a big splash with his first screenplay in 2006. That was a little movie called Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh.
I saw it at the time. I really liked it. I'm sure it is still a good movie, but it might be a little too twee for me now, and it was part of that whole twee indie movement. Mm. Maybe it's due for a reevaluation, but I did like it when it came out. It won Oscar for Best Supporting Actor and Best Original Screenplay, so it's a big Oscar winner, this movie.
It's like a more twee National Lampoon Vacation, as yeah. I remember. I mean, the old person even dies in the middle, right?
I forget, but it's got a little more edge to it than a Wes Anderson movie. It's like it's a little rougher around the edges, I think, than a Wes Anderson movie.
Also, it feels like such a long time ago, like I didn't object to it then, and I'm fine with it now, but like it feels crazy thing, like, oh yeah, Steve Carell playing a gay character, people would now say, like, well, why don't you hire a gay actor for this? Like, why does a straight character get to tell this story?
I forgot the character was gay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, he's gay in comedy ways, not in, like, actually getting to kiss men on screen or anything.
I think that put a bad idea in his head where it's like, I can be in all these quirky indie movies and leave The Office. It's like, no, that was the one good one you were in, and we all know about Sleepy Pancake Man, right?
Oh, God, right, yes. One of the greatest posters of all time, at the very least. Yeah.
And Marwan, he's in that one too.
Yeah, welcome to Marwan, the Bob Zemeckis classic, where you can look at his wife naked in it if you want to, but
we're all looking forward to that.
I think but with the Little Miss Sunshine writer, everybody says this about with the Marvel movies now, you know, like guys like John Watts make one small movie, and then Marvel goes like, all right, subsume him into the beast. This guy's making Marvel movies for like 10 years now. But they did that with writers like the Little Miss Sunshine guy. The Wreck-It Ralph writer, I believe, also wrote a Little Miss Sunshine style script. And then he's like, all right, I'm writing Wreck-It Ralph now. That's my new job.
Yeah, he went from like that small, beloved indie movie to work on things like Oblivion, the second Hunger Games. He was the writer of The Force Awakens.
Right.
Until J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan completely rewrote his script. And for some reason, he credits himself as different names.
Oh,
in movies,
weird.
I don't know, why is it like a gag he has?
Yeah, boy, more of that twee bullshit. Yeah. It sounds like, yeesh. But
yeah, he is still floating around Hollywood. He was at Pixar for a bit. He has a senior creative team credit for movies like WALL-E, Up, Cars 2, and Brave. So he was at Pixar before this too.
Hey man, buy your mansion with that stuff. I'm not, you know, not everybody has to make a twee movie for the rest of your life. Make one of them. And then to get that payday, you know,
maybe his Force Awakens could have been better.
I mean, looking back on it, I loved Seven when I saw the movie. Every year after, I've thought worse and worse of it.
Did he write Chewie, We're Home?
Oh God.
Yeah. It's a little embarrassing.
That fucking JJ, the biggest scam artist in Hollywood.
I know, he's Lyle Landley. So, in February of 2008, Pixar announced the broad strokes of the Toy Story 3 that we know. Nothing was said about it being a genre parody of prison films, though. That was kind of the surprise about the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I remember the promotion being, do you remember the end of Toy Story 2 where they say, hey, when they introduce the idea that Andy could grow up and what happens then? Well, we'll stick together. And this is finally paying that off. Like, okay, that what if at the end of Toy Story 2, now it's finally come to reality in Toy Story 3.
Yeah, one thing I really like about the movie is the darkness. And Unkrich explains on the commentary, like, the summer after Toy Story 2 is the greatest moment of their lives. And you go from that to them just, like, begging to be touched for the first time in a decade. Like, he held me. It's such a dark... I mean, these toys live in hell, and we're going to talk more about that as we get to the movie discussion.
Oh,
but it's a dark fate for all the toys. On the record, Unkrich says, quote, we watched a lot of prison escape movies because we knew there was going to be a kind of escape from the daycare. We watched a lot of films like Cool Hand Luke and The Great Escape. Because we visited a lot of daycares, we couldn't help but notice how there's a very fine line between daycare and prison. You've got exercise yards, you've got walls around them, security cameras everywhere, bins full of toys that look like cells, so we try to embrace that as much as possible and have fun with the conventions of the genre.
Yeah.
And I don't think they first set out to put a period at the end of this franchise, because it seems like in the planning for the story, the big set piece was going to be the breakout and then the ending. The big set piece is really the dump truck and the dump scene. Like, the prison break is not that complex. It's not that big of a set piece.
Well, I think it really works for the dramatic pacing of the movie, though, too, because you think the film's over once they, like, that is another traditional Pixar twist, but I really like it. They give you something like the escape from the place. That's big enough to be the end of a movie and like, oh, and they're free, the end. But they challenge themselves to like, no, no, we got to go bigger than that. And same with, you know, at the end of Toy Story 2, they could just free him at the, you know, in the baggage area, but that it has to be a chase after an airplane. Like, that's the extra level up that makes it even more exciting.
That's true. Yeah, I guess this as follows the trend of having, like, an ending mislead as well. And, yeah, they talk about this big two-day story meeting they had where they hammered out, like, all the details of the film, the broad strokes, and it was, like, very important that they figured out, like, what should this movie be? And based on that meeting, they had their plan they didn't really waver much from outside of, like, a bunch of little minor details.
Yeah. But no moment of going like, flush it all away. Let's start back over again.
Yeah, there was no disastrous screening. There was no like, get Tom Hanks in here to do 30 more rounds of looping. So there was at least one report that Hanks and Ratzenberger said on the record in the press, we won't make this movie if Disney doesn't let Pixar make it. Because, I mean, Ratzenberger is always voicing him. For every like toy and board game and video game, it's like Tom Hanks' brother voicing Woody, and I'm sure like they could have maybe gotten him.
Yeah,
it was important for them to get the original cast for this movie. Even people like the voice actor for Andy, who had stopped voice acting or acting a decade prior.
Yeah, it makes it so much more legitimate that way. Same with like, you know, it was crazy over a year ago hearing Wallace Shawn on Chapo podcast talk about, you know, his socialism and his political beliefs, and then just also knowing like, oh yeah, for 25-6 years he has been a constant employee of Disney, appearing in like a million things.
I think he is always Rex. There's no sound alike for Wallace Shawn. He's
no
there
replacing him. I knew him as a kid and then grew up, and now he's still at it, and I wish him nothing but the best. Wallace Shawn seems like a great dude.
He's looked the same as he did since The Princess Bride.
But
apparently to sell voice actors on their new version of Toy Story 3, they put together a story reel version of the movie, which is basically like storyboard stitched together with temp sound effects and voices. They screened this for at least Hanks, Tim Allen, and Ratzenberger in the same screening. Oh. And as soon as they got out, they're like, we're doing this. Like, this is worth doing.
Damn,
so, yeah.
All right. Wow. That's a success. Gee.
And so you might be wondering, was this movie easy to make? Because, you know, they had the models. Well, there was a lot of extra work to do because technology had changed. Thankfully, the technical director at Pixar, one of them, his name is Guido Caroni. Yes, he plays Guido in Cars.
That's right. All right.
He kept one of his old SGI workstations for Toy Story 2. They were able to import a lot of old data.
Nice.
Yes, but there are so many little changes to all of the models in terms of the textures and the modeling. They improved them in what Lee Anchorage says, a million little ways. To the point where if you're just looking at the Woody from Toy Story 3, you don't realize it's a new Woody until you see the Toy Story 2 Woody. And it's like, oh yeah, I can see like this texture is better. His scarf looks better. His pull string looks better. All these little things they could do with 2010 technology they couldn't do with 1999 technology. And I'm sure the Toy Story 4 Woody looks a lot better than the Toy Story 3 Woody.
But, you know, if you slowly replace polygon by polygon on Woody, is he still the same Woody?
Yeah, I'm not ready for this philosophical discussion. But, yeah, it wasn't a matter of like, oh, yeah, just to download all the toys from the mainframe and make them dance around.
Yeah, it's not like video games. You dress them up. You got to dress them up a little more. And, yeah, everybody looks like themselves, but a little better. If it didn't feel like I was looking at a Toy Story 2 movie. Yeah.
And they did lots of research. They went to like dumps. They went to daycares. They're like, yes, daycares are as chaotic as this portrays.
Yeah. The kids, honestly, that's when I rewatched again, I was like, the little kids, what they do to the toys is technically like, well, you're a ruined toy. Like, you're a dead toy pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, you'll never be good again as a toy. And you can't do that with the toys. Like, they can't be disfigured forever. That would be too sad to do with Jessie. Like, she should always have green hair from then on. But that would be too dark to do.
It's traumatic to see them like mangled like that. These kids are all little SIDS.
Yes. Yeah.
I do like how the movie plays it both ways. I don't like the cutesy poo Bonnie stuff. It's a little too much like Boo from Monsters, Inc. Like the little cutie kitties. But then they're like, no, they're monsters.
Well, Bonnie is, you know, I don't use the term Mary Sue, but I'm kidding. But I do think Bonnie is built to be the perfect little girl who will be the wonderful steward that can have every, again, when she first appeared, I was like, boy, they're making her so special. I have a feeling she's going to be the new kid.
Yeah.
I guess,
I understand why she has to be like this idealized child, because she has to be the Andy replacement.
Yes. Yeah. She is the Rey Skywalker of of these movies.
Hey, she never trained to be a toy owner. What's going on here?
Hay un amigo en mí. Cuando salga